Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, November 10th, 2024. For those listeners who are new to Science Matters, it made its debut on October 3rd, 2021 on Sun Sounds. As its creator and host, I try to include articles from several leading science magazines, Scientific American and Science News, with an occasional New York Times trilobite thrown in. Sometimes I add articles from special journals, like the journal produced by the American Geophysical Union. And sometimes I read articles from the New York Times or Washington Post feature science articles that may not be read on these two newspapers' daily broadcasts. The New York Times trilobites take a lighthearted approach to recent scientific discoveries, as evidenced by the titles that are heavy on puns or reference songs. My favorite is When an Eel Climbs a Ramp to Eat Shrimp from a Clamp, That's a Moray, which references the song popularized by Dean Martin, That's a Moray, which was released in 1953. And sometimes I include articles from The New Yorker, a magazine that covers a wide range of topics, and occasionally a science feature. Because many of the articles are lengthy, I try to read the shorter ones that are no longer than approximately 25 minutes. And finally, to help listeners who may not have a science background, I sometimes include information from Wikipedia so that listeners can better understand the topics being discussed. And keep in mind, if you miss any part of this program today or have missed any of the last several programs, you can access them on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. From the latest issue of Science News, October 19th, 2024. From Notebook, first, Mexican free-tailed bats' toes glow in the dark. You've heard of jazz hands. Well, these bats have glow toes. In the dark, when ultraviolet light shines on the Mexican free-tailed bat's extraordinary hairy toes, they light up like a Christmas tree. That's because the animals have bristly structures that are capable of UV-induced photoluminescence, scientists reported on August 8th in the journal Mammalian Biology. The finding marks the first time that photoluminescent structures have been reported in live bats and places the Mexican free-tailed bat on an ever-growing list of creatures that can absorb UV light and re-emit it at a different wavelength. Biologist Fernando Wall Suarez says he will always remember the moment he heard a colleague utter, "Is that normal? Do the feet usually look like that?" It was January 2021, and his team had been catching Mexican free-tailed bats outside of a well-known roost in southern Mexico City. The night before, the researchers had caught bats further north and dusted them with a powder that shines under UV light. The hope was to later detect that powder on bats in the south, proving that the animals were moving between the locations. "We failed at that," says Juan Suarez of the National Autonomous University of Mexico in Mexico City. However, while searching for signs of the powder with their UV flashlights, the team stumbled upon something even cooler on the powderless bats: glow-in-the-dark toes. In visible light, a Mexican free-tailed bat looks like a fluff of dark fur. To be sure, the photoluminescent footsies weren't a result of powder residue or a local aberration, the researchers looked for and found similarly bright toes on 25 live bats at both sites, as well as on one bat captured more than 700 kilometers to the north. Scientists have found UV photoluminescence in platypuses, tardigrades, and other creatures. While many of these animals glow essentially from head to toe, in the bats, it's just the toes. What purpose the glowing toes serve is unclear. It's not yet known whether the bats can perceive the light wavelengths that appear as a brilliant scion to the human eye. As nocturnal creatures, Mexican free-tailed bats would encounter UV light mostly at dusk, dawn, and nights when the moon is unobstructed by clouds. Because the species migrates long distances and lives in colonies of millions of individuals, perhaps the glow toes aid communication, the team says. Mexican free-tailed bats, and there's a picture of it soaring with its wings fully outstretched, migrate thousands of kilometers and live in large colonies. Scientists suspect that the bats' light-up toes might serve a role in nighttime communication. This article posted by Jason Bittle. Next in the news, the Department of Plants. This flower launches missiles of pollen. The projectiles knock off competitors' pollen from bird beaks. For certain Brazilian red flowers, pollinators may act as sexual battlegrounds. Certain flowers use projectile blasts of pollen to knock off rival flowers' pollen from hummingbirds' beaks and replace it with their own, researchers reported in a study that is going to appear in the journal American Naturalist. The tactic may increase a male flower's chances of siring seeds in the next female flower the bird visits. H. macrantha flowers have both male and female reproductive organs. To avoid self-pollination, a flower goes through a male phase and then a female phase. Hummingbirds transfer pollen between flowers. When visiting a male flower, a hummingbird's beak triggers a catapult-like mechanism that flings all of the flower's pollen in a single burst. Afterward, the flower becomes female. To see if projectile pollen blows away the competition, evolutionary ecologist Bruce Anderson of Stellenbosch University in South Africa and his colleagues simulated hummingbird visits by poking a hummingbird skull into flowers. First, the researchers applied pollen marked with tiny fluorescent particles to the part of the beak where pollen tends to accumulate. Next, the team inserted the bird's beak with its load of fluorescent pollen into a set of male and female flowers containing unmarked pollen and tracked where the marked and unmarked pollen particles ended up. The hummingbird beaks lost twice as much fluorescent pollen when inserted into an explosive flower versus an inert, already exploded flower. And the more fluorescent pollen an explosion removed, the more successful that explosion was at depositing the flower's own pollen onto the beak. High-speed video showed that pollen grains from exploding flowers functioned like missiles that knock existing pollen away. It's almost like there's a division of labor for pollen. Some of it is meant for mating, and some of it's meant for fighting, Anderson says. More research is needed, he adds, to determine whether the pollen blasts result in more offspring for H. macrantha. The animal world is full of males trying to get rid of rivals' sperm and replace it with their own. For example, many animal penises have elaborate structures for scooping sperm out of the female reproductive tract. Even the capped shape of the human penis may function to remove other men's sperm, research from evolutionary psychologist Rebecca Birch and her colleagues suggests. This is the first experimental evidence for a similar sperm cell removal strategy in plants. Plants are not just stationary objects, says Birch, of the State University of New York at Oswego. They engage in communication, competition, and now active reproductive sabotage of other plants. This article posted by Nala Rogers. Next, in the Department of Animals, stem cell feet could help pandas. The advance could aid breeding and conservation efforts. With roughly 2,000 giant pandas remaining in the wild, scientists have spent the last several decades looking for new ways to help the iconic black and white bears stave off extinction. And now, it seems, there may be more hope than ever before. For the first time, scientists have transformed ordinary skin cells from pandas in a zoo into induced pluripotent stem cells, the team reported in the September 20th issue of Science Advances. Having this type of stem cell, which can be nudged into becoming any kind of cell in the body, could help researchers breed more giant pandas and develop treatments for their diseases. This result is really a great breakthrough in the field of giant panda conservation, says Thomas Hildebrandt, a veterinarian who specializes in wildlife reproduction at the Free University of Berlin. It opens up a complete new avenue to rescue this magnificent species and may suggest strategies for generating stem cells for other endangered species. Researchers have already turned both mouse and human skin cells, called fibroblasts, into pluripotent stem cells. These stem cells have unlimited proliferation potential and can form any kind of cell, tissue, or organ in the body under certain conditions, says Liu Jing, a stem cell researcher at the Chinese Academy of Sciences, Guangzhou Institutes of Biomedicine and Health. The catch is that the process for creating such cells must be tailored to each species. To reprogram panda fibroblasts into pluripotent stem cells, Jing and colleagues first inserted genes known to reprogram adult cells into panda skin cells, along with small RNA molecules known to enhance the transformation into stem cells. The researchers also had to identify the specific proteins and growth factors that would help turn the panda's skin cells into stem cells, as well as ones that would keep them in the pluripotent state. Having pluripotent cells on demand could allow scientists to create giant panda primordial germ cells, precursors to sperm and egg cells, a feat that's been done in mice and northern white rhinos. Obtaining panda sex cells has been difficult because the majority of the remaining pandas in the wild are under strict protections that forbid typical egg extraction techniques. There are also too few pandas remaining to reliably harvest eggs from animals as they die from natural causes. If scientists could generate sperm and egg cells from pandas in a non-invasive manner, such as turning skin cells into stem cells and then germ cells, and use those cells to make new pandas, scientists might be able to add genetic diversity to different panda populations. Currently, there are 33 isolated populations, 15 of which are very close to extinction. Creating primordial germ cells from these stem cells is the team's next step. But assisting pandas' reproduction is not the only goal. Pluripotent stem cells can help in disease diagnosis and treatment. Ultimately, Jing says, the hope is to both expand the giant population and improve the population's health. The findings may also hold potential for achieving in the stem cell transformation in other endangered species. It's like a library you use, says Hildebrandt, who has been instrumental in similar efforts to prevent northern white rhinos from going extinct. You know, there are a lot of books which describe a similar thing, but describe it from a different angle. Scientists have also created pluripotent cells, stem cells, for Tasmanian devils, Grevy's zebras, Sumatran rhinos, and drills. With another book added to the library, who knows which species scientists will be able to apply the stem cell technology to next. And this article is posted by Jason Biddle. Also in the Department of Animals, ants renovate nests to stop pathogens. Structural and behavioral changes might reduce disease spread. If an infection takes hold in an ant nest, it could spell disaster for the whole colony. But some worker ants appear to have a remedy. When exposed to a pathogen, black garden ants tinker with their nest layout in ways that could slow the spread of disease. Several animals are known to alter their behavior to avoid infections. But the ants' behavior, reported September 2nd in a paper posted at biorxiv.org, is the first example of non-human animals actively altering their surroundings in an apparent response to infection. Limiting social contact through social distancing, for example, is thought to be an effective barrier to disease spread. Humans also alter what researchers call spatial networks by, for instance, using quarantine zones. To see whether ants act similarly, behavioral ecologist Natalie Stroymate and her team at the University of Bristol in England let 20 groups of 180 black garden ants excavate nests in soil-filled jars. The day after digging started, the researchers added 20 more worker ants to each jar, with half of the jars receiving ants infected with a fungal pathogen. Over the next 6 days, the team monitored the ants' behavior with video and used micro-CT scans to study the evolution of the nests. Ant colonies exposed to the pathogen dug nests faster and initially made more tunnels than healthy colonies. After 6 days, the exposed colonies had made several structural modifications, including spacing entrances 0.62 centimeters further apart on average. Those colonies had also placed chambers, which house resources such as queens and food, in less central locations. And infected ants had spent more time at the surface than their co-workers, perhaps a form of self-isolation. Simulations of how disease might spread in the nest designs, crafted by the exposed and unexposed colonies, suggest that ant colonies in the redesigned nests would have a lower fungal load and fewer lethal doses than ant colonies in more typical nests. The findings are fascinating, though not surprising, says Sebastian Stockmeyer, a behavioral disease ecologist at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Social insects like ants, bees, and termites have evolved a range of colony-level defenses to effectively manage diseases, he says, and large-scale outbreaks are rare. Group living is generally thought to increase the risk of disease, and this threat is particularly pronounced in social insects because of their low genetic diversity and frequent social interactions, factors which help disease to spread. Therefore, when faced with disease, Stockmeyer says, their strategies are typically targeted at protecting the group as a whole rather than focusing on the individual. And this article was posted by Richard Kameny. And from the Department of Chemistry, hydrogen saps energy from batteries. Wrangling the atoms may be key to longer-lasting lithium-ion cells. Rechargeable lithium-ion batteries don't last forever. Over time, they hold on to less charge and eventually transform from power sources to bricks. A new study suggests one reason: leaky hydrogen. Unwanted hydrogen protons fill molecular slots in the positive end of the battery, leaving less room for charged lithium atoms, or ions, that maintain reactivity and help conduct charge, researchers reported in the September 13th issue of Science. The study identifies a set of undesirable chemical reactions that unfold when the battery's electrolyte, which is supposed to transport lithium atoms, had inadvertently released oxygen into the positive end, or cathode. This triggers all kinds of problems, reducing the capacity and lifespan of the battery, says materials physicist Gang Wan of Stanford University. Even if you're not using the battery, it loses energy. Explanations of energy loss in batteries typically focus on lithium ions. Some researchers have hypothesized that hydrogen atoms play a role, but it has been hard to observe because hydrogen is so small and ubiquitous. So Wan and colleagues swapped the hydrogen in the electrolyte of button-shaped batteries for deuterium, a heavier variant of hydrogen. The researchers then tracked the deuterium's movement with high-powered X-ray imaging and mass spectrometry. Combining the results with theoretical calculations showed that hydrogen is the key player in cathode charge loss. The study sheds light on the opaque chemistry unfolding inside batteries, says inorganic chemist Bart Bartlett of the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. That's significant because it hints at ways to adjust the chemistry to avoid hydrogen reactions. The work also highlights a problem in the push for increasingly high-voltage batteries, he says. Higher voltage cathodes are more reactive and thus more likely to pull in hydrogen. So the higher the battery voltage, the more hydrogenation takes place. It's a trade-off that I don't think we fully appreciated, Bartlett says. It's unclear whether the findings apply to other types of lithium-ion batteries. If so, the results could help speed up innovations like longer-range electric vehicles, says Jacqueline Edge, a batteries researcher at Imperial College London. Those new batteries might also decrease the need for mining battery minerals, which comes with negative environmental and social consequences. It would be a twofold sustainability win, she says. And this article posted by Lauren Leffler. And this series of articles appears in the October 19th, 2024 issue of Science News. While some scientists are looking at ways to extend the lives of lithium-ion batteries, others are looking at a new option to replace them. From the Washington Post's Climate Solutions, lithium-ion batteries have ruled for decades. Now they have a challenger. Sodium-ion batteries are emerging as a possible alternative. After decades of lithium-ion batteries dominating the market, a new option has emerged: batteries made with sodium ions. Scientists have been researching alternatives to lithium for years. Much of the world relies on this kind of battery, but the mining and processing of its materials can be harmful to workers, local communities, and the environment. Sodium has recently emerged as one of the more promising options, and experts say the material could be a cheaper and more environmentally friendly alternative to lithium. In the past few years, sodium-ion battery production has increased in the United States. Last month, sodium-ion battery manufacturer Natron Energy announced it would open a gigafactory in North Carolina that would produce 24 gigawatts of batteries annually, enough energy to charge 24,000 electric vehicles. But sodium-ion batteries are still early in their development compared with lithium-ion, and they have yet to hit the market on a massive scale. It's unlikely sodium-ion could displace lithium-ion anytime soon, said Keith Beers, polymer science and materials chemistry principal engineer at technical consultancy firm Exponent. Here's what to know about these batteries. How sodium-ion batteries work. There are many types of sodium-ion batteries, but the ones that will be manufactured in North Carolina are produced in the same way as lithium-ion batteries, just with different ingredients. Instead of using expensive materials like lithium, nickel, and cobalt, these will be made of sodium, iron, and manganese. In a battery, ions move between electrodes during a charging and discharging process to generate electricity, explains Alvaro Acosta, a senior director at the solar developer Lightsource BP. In a sodium-ion battery, sodium ions carry the charge, and the negative electrode is made up of common materials like iron, carbon, and nitrogen. Natron's batteries use iron and manganese for their negative electrodes. The biggest limitation of sodium-ion batteries is their weight. Sodium weighs nearly three times as much as lithium, and it cannot store the same amount of energy. As a result, sodium-ion batteries tend to be larger. Jens Peters, an economics professor at the University of Alcalá in Madrid, said the energy density could be improved over time in sodium-ion batteries. But he added, "What we found out so far in our assessments is that it is not a game changer." Are they more sustainable? Sodium-ion batteries are touted to be the environmentally friendly alternative to their lithium-ion counterparts, thanks to their raw materials. Sodium, iron, and manganese are all abundant elements on the planet, so they require less energy to extract and cost less. Everyone knows that lithium-ion batteries are the pulse of mobile phones, transportation, said Yang Kuk Soon, professor of energy engineering at Hanyang University in Seoul. The issue over lithium-ion batteries is that they use highly expensive materials like lithium, nickel, and cobalt. The environmental and human costs of that extractive mining are also issues. And at the end of their life, batteries made with these materials can leach toxins into the environment if disposed of improperly. Sodium-ion batteries also last longer than lithium-ion ones because they can withstand more charge cycles, said Wendell Brooks, co-CEO of Natron Energy. Our product can have millions of cycles, said Brooks, where lithium-ion would have 3,000 to 5,000 cycles and wear out a lot faster. But not all sodium-ion batteries are built alike, Beers said, or perform the same. And if a sodium-ion battery were to use the heavy metals found in lithium-ion batteries, then the environmental impact would likely be similar. Will they replace lithium? Experts say that sodium-ion batteries have limited uses compared with their lithium-ion counterparts, which currently power much of the technology in our lives, from smartphones to power tools to solar power backup storage. Their biggest selling point is their small size and energy density. They're small enough to fit in a camera, and a larger battery in your electric car can hold enough charge to drive a few hundred miles. Sodium-ion batteries aren't the best fit for smartphones or electric vehicles, which need to store lots of energy. However, one advantage is their low cost, and they could be a good candidate in situations where the size of the battery isn't a concern, like energy storage. When something is built out to support grid or backup storage, it doesn't need to be very dense. It's staying put, Beers said. And this article, written by Sarah Raza, was posted in the Washington Post on November 3, 2024. Under Climate Solutions, lithium-ion batteries have ruled for decades. Now they have a challenger. Sodium-ion batteries are emerging as a possible alternative. Last week, this program featured a story from the October 5, 2024 issue of Science News entitled Fruit Flies Help African Research Take Flight. It focused on the fact that what has traditionally been used in labs for research, rodents, aren't always the best choice. In fact, in the hierarchy of lab animal all-stars, roundworms come on top and have been the lab animal of choice in the award-winning work of several recent Nobel Prize recipients. After the roundworm, we have the zebrafish, and we, of course, have the fruit fly, and as a fellow primate, the rhesus macaque is often used. And then there is the mouse. The dilemma of lab rats is profiled in an article in the September 2024 issue of Scientific American. The End of the Lab Rat, from the Department of Biomedicine, replacing research animals with tools that better mimic human biology could improve medicine. The article written by Rachel Neuer. When it came time for Itzi Morales Pantoja to start her PhD in cellular and molecular medicine, she chose a laboratory that used stem cells, not only animals, for its research. Morales Pantoja had just spent 2 years studying multiple sclerosis in mouse models. As an undergraduate, she'd been responsible for giving the animals painful injections to induce the disease, and then observing as they lost their ability to move. She did her best to treat the mice gently, but she knew they were suffering. As soon as I got close to them, they'd start peeing, a sign of stress, she says. They knew what was coming. Even though the mouse work was emotionally very, very difficult, says Morales Pantoja, she remained committed to her research out of a desire to help her sister, who has multiple sclerosis. 3 years after the project wrapped up, however, Morales Pantoja was crushed to find that none of her results would be of any direct help to people like her sister. An antioxidant she tested seemed promising in mice, but in human samples, it was ineffective. This was a disappointment, but not a surprise. Around 90% of novel drugs that work in animal models fail in human clinical trials, an attrition rate that contributes to a $2.3 billion average price tag for every new drug that comes to market. Today, Morales Pantoja is a postdoctoral fellow at the Johns Hopkins Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing, where she is helping to develop lab-grown models of the human brain. The goal is to advance scientific understanding of neurodegeneration while moving the field beyond what some researchers see as an antiquated reliance on animal models. Millions of rodents, dogs, monkeys, rabbits, birds, cats, fish, and other animals are used every year for research purposes worldwide. Exact numbers are hard to come by, but advocacy group Cruelty Free International estimated that 192 million animals were used in 2015. Most of this work occurs in four broad domains: cosmetics and personal products, chemical toxicity testing, drug development, and drug discovery research. Animal-based studies have contributed to important findings and life-saving medical advancements. The COVID vaccines, for instance, were developed in animals, including mice and non-human primates. Animal models have also been critical in advancing AIDS drugs and in developing treatments for leukemia and other cancers, among many other uses. But animal studies often fall short of producing useful results. They may weed out possibly effective drugs or miss toxicity in humans. They have failed to deliver breakthroughs in certain fields of medicine, including neurological conditions. A 2014 study estimated that candidate therapies for Alzheimer's disease, developed in animal models, have failed in clinical trials about 99.6% of the time. As questions about human biology and variability get more complex, we are bumping up against the limits of animal models, says Paul Locke, an environmental health scientist and attorney at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The thing you run into with animals, and there's no way to get around this, is that animal biology is just too difficult from human biology. Other species are no longer providing the insights about human biology, including at the cellular and subcellular levels, that scientists today need to achieve innovations. A growing multidisciplinary community of researchers around the world is investigating alternatives to animal models. Some are motivated by concerns about animal welfare, but for many, sparing the lives of millions of creatures is just an added bonus. They are driven primarily to create technologies and methods that will approximate human biology and variability better than animals do. For the past decade or so, dozens of labs, startups, and nonprofit groups have pursued alternative methods that range from machine learning tools that predict chemical toxicity to living organs on a chip that can be combined to replicate human organ systems. Their efforts have now matured to the point where some labs are phasing animals out entirely. Research is beginning to show that these new methods often provide significantly more accurate answers than animals do. Legislation is beginning to reflect these developments. In 2021, the European Parliament passed a resolution to phase out animal testing in research. Australia's National Science Agency has begun seriously exploring non-animal models for medical product development. In 2022, President Joe Biden signed a bill that did away with the long-standing U.S. Food and Drug Administration requirement for animal testing as a part of every new drug application. In May 2023, the state of Maryland passed a first-of-its-kind law mandating that animal testing labs contribute to a fund that will be directed to other labs developing human-relevant alternatives. Another federal bill, introduced in 2024, would pave the way for the FDA to begin accepting data from new methodologies on a wide scale. This convergence of developments in legislation, industry, and science will bring about a sea change in how we conduct biomedical research, says Danilo Tagle, director of a group at the U.S. National Institutes of Health that is leading an institution-wide push to invest in alternatives to animal models. This year, the NIH is launching a $300 million fund that specifically supports the development, validation, and testing of non-animal alternatives for drug screening, disease modeling, and more. This resource will be on top of the 8% of the NIH's $40 billion research budget already awarded for alternative methods, a percentage that has been rising for the past 15 years. As Togla says, we are seeing a convergence in legislation, industry, and scientific developments. In 1937, when 12 patients came to Archibald "Archie" Calhoun complaining of infections, the physician from Covington County, Mississippi, did what he often did. He wrote them prescriptions for sulfanilamide, an antibiotic he'd used for years. Within days, six of the patients were dead. The pharmaceutical company that produced sulfanilamide had added a new ingredient to the raspberry-flavored formula, diethylene glycol, a type of antifreeze, which turned out to be deadly. This realization has given me such days and nights of mental and spiritual agony as I did not believe a human being could undergo and survive, Calhoun wrote afterward. The sulfanilamide disaster, as the incident became known, took the lives of more than 100 people, many of them children. Congress responded with the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, a set of laws designed to ensure that no company would ever again unknowingly sell a toxic drug. Among other things, the act required that new drugs in development be tested on animals before being given to humans. An early success of animal models was to keep these horrible products off the market, Locke says. Today, animal models are still considered the standard for pharmaceutical and drug discovery research, partly because many people in the scientific community still get value from them, and partly because they're the status quo. Yet the full extent of animal use in the U.S. is unknown. Federal laws do not require researchers to make public the number of rats, mice, and birds, the three species that make up more than 95% of testing subjects, bred for research purposes. Likewise, no comprehensive analyses have tallied the amount of U.S. government-funded research that uses animal models. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, has estimated that just under half of NIH research funding goes toward animal-based studies. Organizations outside of government and academia use animals for research as well. The Humane Society of the U.S. estimates that more than 50 million animals are used for research purposes every year in the U.S. alone. Locke and others say it's not a question of whether animal testing will be phased out of most research, but when. The cosmetics and personal products industry is the furthest along in doing away with animal testing, primarily because of consumer demand. More than 2,500 North American cosmetics, personal care, and household product companies are certified as animal-free. 12 U.S. states and 45 countries have banned animal-tested cosmetics, and legislation reintroduced in the House in September 2023 could add the full U.S. to that list. Phasing animals out of some type of toxicity testing, carried out to establish a substance's potential to cause harm, is probably next in line. Numerous studies have shown that, in many cases, artificial intelligence-based algorithms trained with pre-existing data are as reliable as or more reliable than animals in predicting toxicity for various chemicals. In 2016, President Barack Obama signed an amendment to the Toxic Substances Control Act, directing the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, to begin reducing the use of vertebrate animals in toxicity testing and replacing it with alternative methods if scientifically feasible. The EPA has made some progress toward this goal. In 2018, for example, the agency granted 62 waiver requests for reductions in animals undergoing certain toxicity testing, sparing around 16,500 animals and resulting in savings of about $8.9 million in its first year. In 2024, the EPA published a new framework for assessing eye irritation or corrosion through alternative test methods. To see what the future of human-centric models might look like, I visited Emulate, a biotechnology company in Boston. Emulate specializes in organ chips, flexible polymer platforms about an inch long that duplicate human cell and tissue microenvironments. Sushma Yadalanagari, a tissue engineer, let me play lab tech. Working in a biosafety cabinet, I sucked up Tri-Pan blue dye and inserted a pipette tip into a tiny divot in the top of a pristine chip. As I released the fluid, a thin inky line appeared along a hollow channel that crisscrossed the chip and ended at another opening at the opposite end. A second channel ran below that one, separated from it by a porous membrane. Real researchers seed this kind of chip's channels, not with dye, but with human cells. Multiple chips, each lined with different types of organ-specific cells and tissues, can be linked to mimic multi-organ systems, and researchers can run experiments on one or more chips by flowing fluid or air across the cells, exerting mechanical forces on them, or adding things such as pharmaceuticals, cigarette smoke, chemicals, viruses, or bacteria. Emulate's chips can stand in for liver, kidney, colon, and duodenum, and the company also offers blank chips that can be customized. Outside researchers have used the chips to create about 70 additional models with cells from their labs. Emulate's customers are pharmaceutical firms, academic labs, and government facilities. Emulate spun out of the Weiss Institute at Harvard University, based on the work of Don Ingber, an animal-loving cell biologist and bioengineer, who began developing in vitro models 40 years ago because he didn't like experimenting on living creatures. "I used to joke that I was raised by dogs, but now a cat rules my life," Ingber says. His work on organ chips was fast-tracked in 2012 when he and his colleagues received a $37 million grant from the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency to develop the technologies. Ingber is now regularly approached by agencies, foundations, and companies with offers to apply for funding. Emulate is one of a growing number of businesses pursuing alternative methods that scientists can use in their research, a space only 5 to 10 companies were exploring a decade ago. These tests and devices are not designed to be exact replicas of human organs in healthy or disease states, nor are they meant to serve as one-to-one replacements of animal models. Rather, the goal is to recapitulate functions and features that scientists need to study for a particular problem. A liver chip doesn't have to perfectly simulate a human organ. It just needs to accurately answer a question that researchers are using it to address. Emulate's liver chip is the company's most popular organ model. That's because one of the primary reasons new drugs fail is that animal models don't reveal human hepatotoxicity, a condition that occurs when the liver is damaged by exposure to harmful substances. In a study published in 2022 in the journal Communications Medicine, an Emulate-led team evaluated 870 liver chips across a blinded set of 27 known hepatotoxic and non-toxic drugs. The chips correctly identified 87% of hepatotoxic drugs, none of which were detected with animal models. Further, the chips did not inaccurately label any safe drugs as toxic, as animal models commonly do. Based on these findings, the authors calculated that the pharmaceutical industry could generate an additional $3 billion or more a year if it routinely used liver chips. Increasing so-called predictive capability saves time, money, and animal lives, according to a 2022 case study by Moderna. The pharmaceutical company used Emulate's liver chips to screen 35 drug delivery molecule candidates. The liver chips allowed it to complete that task in a year and a half at a cost of $325,000. If the company had performed the same tests in non-human primates, Moderna says, it would have cost more than $5 million and taken 5 years. Academic labs are also inventing new tools. Vasilika Machairaki, a molecular biologist at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, has been creating a non-animal model of Alzheimer's disease, inspired by her grandmother's diagnosis. She uses blood samples collected from people with Alzheimer's to make stem cells, which she differentiates into brain cells and brain organoids, self-assembled three-dimensional tissue cultures that look a bit like trays of pale Dippin' Dots. The organoids begin to show signs of their donor's pathology within about 4 months, enabling the researchers to test the effectiveness of various pharmaceuticals against Alzheimer's. This is a personalized model that could eventually tell you the best drugs to use for different patients, she says. In a Johns Hopkins lab headed by biomedical engineer Duk-ho Kim, researchers culture human heart tissue across plates holding 24 dime-size wells. Electrodes stimulate the heart tissue with an electric current, and magnetic sensors allow the researchers to measure the twitching force of the beating muscle. Some lab members are testing the cardiotoxicity and effectiveness of new chemotherapy drugs, many of which fail in humans because they are unsafe or don't work, and others are screening new therapies for muscular dystrophy, a group of wasting diseases. Treatments have been found to improve symptoms of some forms of the disease in mouse models, but they don't work in human patients, many of whom die from heart failure in their 30s. The engineered heart models, like the brain organoids, are derived from stem cells that carry the genes of their donors. This opens up opportunities for studying patients who have been traditionally overlooked in research, including ones with rare diseases for which no animal model exists at all, Toggle says. Rare diseases are poorly studied, and there's little interest in developing animal models for them because it takes a lot of time and effort. Molecular biologist Anika Harriet says the ability to do experiments that are directly relevant to the patient was a motivating factor in her decision to join Kim's lab as a postdoctoral fellow. Harriet was diagnosed with a rare blood clotting disorder when she was a child, and doctors couldn't tell her anything about her prognosis because the small number of patients with her condition had precluded clinical trials. Conducting research with human stem cells rather than animal models helps to shift this work toward equity, she says. Conferences dedicated to exploring alternatives to animal-dependent methods, such as the Microphysiological Systems World Summit, attract 1,000 or more attendees. Many of them are doctoral students and postdocs who are looking to build a scientific career using what they see as the tools of the future. In November 2022, U.S. federal prosecutors unsealed an unusual indictment, felony charges against 8 people for allegedly running an international monkey trafficking ring. Until 2020, China was the world's largest supplier of captive-bred lab monkeys, but wildlife trade bans during the COVID pandemic triggered an international shortage in lab monkeys, around 70,000 of which are used every year in the U.S. alone. According to the government, the trafficking group had used false documents to smuggle hundreds of illegally captured wild, long-tailed macaques and endangered species from Cambodia to Florida and Texas to supply the research industry. Locke sees this hot mess as something that should have been a glaring message to the scientific community about the need to be more proactive in its pivot away from lab animals and toward human-centric alternatives. By and large, though, that wasn't the reaction. Instead, the research community screams, "We need more macaques," Locke says, a short-sightedness that he equates to asking in the 1950s, "How do we get more slide rules?" The cultural shift away from animals has not been easy. To say you want to have a research career but don't want to do animal work, you're still a little bit laughed at, says Antonia Eggert, a a physician at the University Medical Center Freiburg in Germany. On top of that, it's difficult for researchers to make the transition because regulators have yet to clearly spell out what is needed for an alternative model to replace an existing animal-based test, says Brianne Kincaid, a doctoral student in environmental engineering at Johns Hopkins. Although the FDA and EPA broadly state that they will accept non-animal toxicity data, their regulators have not put pen to paper to say these are the accepted standards you need to meet to use your model, she continues. This means scientists who use alternative methods have no guarantee that findings they submit to regulators won't simply be met with a vote of no confidence and a request for additional animal data. Policymakers have also sent mixed signals about whether labs should be investing in alternative methods. When President Biden signed the FDA Modernization Act 2.0 in 2022, the new law did away with the 1938 mandate that animal testing be a part of every new drug application and authorized the use of the best non-clinical model instead. The Modernization Act is a really encouraging sign of change, Locke says, but it has yet to filter down to specific guidelines, standards, or policies. In response to questions about the agency's plans for translating the Modernization Act to real-world decision-making, an FDA spokesperson wrote, "While the FDA is committed to doing all that it can to reduce the reliance on animal-based studies in the broad context of human drug development, animal testing is scientifically necessary in most circumstances because the current state of science does not support replacing all animal studies with alternative methods." That stance could change if the FDA Modernization Act 3.0, introduced by legislators in February 2024, is passed. It would require the FDA to establish a process for qualifying new methodologies so they can be used for drug development. This year, the NIH distributed upwards of $30 million to several academic centers that will work with input from the FDA over the next 5 years to qualify some organ and tissue chips as sanctioned drug development tools. If the bill passes, I'd anticipate a surge in demand for these things, largely coming from the pharmaceutical industry, Toggle says. Toggle and his colleagues recently secured around $300 million from the NIH Common Fund for a 10-year project to develop and validate new methods for biomedical research. The Complement Animal Research in Experimentation program will encourage interdisciplinary teams that include engineers, computational scientists, and physicists to advance scientific development and regulatory acceptance of non-animal methods. Reaching the next generation of scientists through workshops and conferences is another integral part of the plan, Toggle says, so that when they start their own labs, it becomes natural for them to employ those new technologies. And this feature article in the September 2024 issue of Scientific American is entitled, "The End of the Lab Rat? Replacing Research Animals with Tools That Better Mimic Human Biology Could Improve Medicine." But wait, one study outlined in Health and Medicine News in Brief, again in the October 19, 2024 issue of Science News, is entitled, "A Study in Mice Hints at a New Way to Treat Spinal Cord Injuries." After a spinal cord injury, some mouse nerve cells swell, stay that way longer than expected, and begin dying. A drug that reduces swelling improved the mice's recovery, scientists reported in Science Translational Medicine. A team led by neuroscientist Bo Chen of the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston examined tens of thousands of neurons in mouse spinal cords. Inhibitory neurons, which dampen other cells' activity, swelled quickly after an injury, peaking at the day 2 and returning to normal size by day 14. But excitatory neurons, which ramp up other cells' activities, stayed swollen for up to 35 days, and more of them died. Giving mice bumetanide, a drug used to treat edema, decreased cell swelling and death, and improved leg movement. Neuron swelling may be an important part of spinal cord injuries in people, but more research is needed to understand how this process works and whether bumetanide might help, Chen says. This news brief written by Laura Sanders. Maybe it's not the end of rodents in the lab just yet. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.